One of the cherished stories about the founding of the United States is the belief that the country would be a class-free society where anyone could rise above their circumstances through a combination of hard work and perseverance. But our next guest says it wasn't true then, and it's still not true today. Discussions of class and the 1% have been at the center of political debates leading up to the presidential election in November. She says these conversations often ignore the long history in our country of privilege and class divide.
Nancy Eisenberg joins us now. She's a professor of American history at Louisiana State University and the author of the new book, White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America. Nancy, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well, thanks. Well, you say that throughout its history, America has always had a class system. And, you know, like we just heard, this is not the narrative that most of us grow up hearing about our country. It's the foundational story that there are no classes and anybody can move up. Why do you disagree with that?
Well, I disagree because the facts just don't back it up. The reason we have that myth is it goes back to the idea, and this is ideas that can be traced back to Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, Tom Paine, but they all argued that because the United States was going to expand westward and fill this large continent, that that magically would solve class competition. This is particularly the ideas of Benjamin Franklin. Franklin argued that if people, particularly poor people, were pushed into the West or migrated into the West, that essentially that would flatten out the class system and create what he called a happy mediocrity. But this was an old theory, a theory he got from the British, because one of the points that I make from the very beginning, the British, when they thought about what North America would be used for, would be a place for dumping the poor. And this was carried on by Franklin and Jefferson and others who, and this idea later develops into the safety valve theory, that somehow the poor can be released into the West, and somehow, if they make it there, then they can rise up the class ladder. But the fact is, what that really offers is horizontal mobility, not upward mobility. And as poor people did actually move into the back country or the old Northwest during the early Republic and the early antebellum period, what we found is that they were dismissed as squatters and crackers. They were called by Jefferson trespassers. And they were associated with the landless. And they weren't given any advantages as they moved west because large land speculators, large landholders had better connection to the land office and also ended up getting the best land. So the class system was just replicated as people moved west. So that's one of my big points, is that we have confused horizontal mobility for upward mobility.
And before we go too much farther, I want to talk about the term itself, the title of your book, White Trash. I mean, it is a loaded term in a lot of ways. What are you trying to get at by using that term?
Well, the actual term white trash, as people who've tried to study when it first was used in newspapers, is in the 1820s. But it has a much older history. And as I alluded to in the first answer, we did not escape British thinking about poverty or class after the American Revolution. And that's another myth. We assume that we broke free and we created a brand new nation. In fact, what the British thought of, as I mentioned, about dumping the poor into the new world, they referred to them as waste people. Now, where did that idea come from? Well, we forget that America, as Great Britain, celebrated the idea of an agrarian economy, and we've been an agrarian nation for over half of our history. So what was the measure of civic worth and value was the land and property. What was the word that was used to describe worthless land, swampy land, scrubby land, unfallow land that was left fallow, wasteland? So this is another point that I try to emphasize, is that throughout our history, there's been an intimate connection, both politically, metaphorically, between how we think about class, how we think about who's valuable in society, and its connections to land and property ownership. And that's still with us today, because we still look at owning a home as an important measure of being in the middle class.
So when you talk about this using of the New World as sort of a dumping ground for the poor, Is that something that the founding figures of our country were complicit in, or did they just sort of inherit it and then try to rid themselves of it but just not do it very well? How involved were they?
Well, you have to imagine that the founders started out being British subjects. They also very much believed in British ideas. Franklin was one of the first advocates of demography, political arithmetic. And they all subscribed to this idea that a nation's strength was in its numbers. So they embraced certain English ideas. As far as the poor goes, and the founders sort of engaged in two different strategies. Sometimes they would ignore the poor, as Tom Paine does. Sometimes they would attack the poor, as Franklin does. I mean, he would write scathing newspaper pieces attacking the poor moving into Philadelphia or Pennsylvania, attacking convict labor. You have to realize that most Americans at the time of the American Revolution would fall into the category of being unfree. That means not only slave labor, but apprentices. Franklin himself was a runaway apprentice, a runaway servant. We also had high numbers of convict laborers. So to sort of say that they weren't aware of this, they were completely aware of it. And these patterns of how poor laborers were used, was a part of the colonial inheritance. And what I'm trying to suggest is that even though they were aware of this, they realized that they were going to apply the same basic solution. But the key was pushing the poor somewhere else, dumping them in the frontier. This is a prevalent idea. This is an idea that we also still have today. If you think about urban renewal, and this is one of the issues that I'm raising, is that class has a geography. And we still adhere, if you live in a good neighborhood and you have all the amenities, a good grocery store, a good school, you have a clear class advantage over someone who's not only, as I highlight, not only if we think about poor black urban areas, but in the case of poor whites, one of the major areas of poverty that would develop in the post-World War II area were called hillbilly havens. And these were the sites of trailer parks. And it's really symbolic that the trailer, or trailer trash, is associated with the other group that the English hated, which were vagrants, the mobile poor. And if you think about a trailer, what's a trailer? It's a home with wheels.
We're talking right now with Nancy Eisenberg. She's the T. Harry Williams Professor of American History at Louisiana State University, and she's the author of the new book called White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America. And Nancy, you write about contempt for the poor. What would the beginning of that history be, and where do you think it is today?
I show there are moments where there are attempts to tell a more populist story about the poor. In the antebellum period, this is usually sort of associated with what's known as the common man and the way Jackson was able to appeal to the common man. And I highlight a very popular story about Shug the squatter, which makes them far less dangerous and volatile, which is how most people wrote about squatters. They would actually physically chase people off the land that they had title to if they felt they had an earlier claim to it. So you do have these populist moments, but they're usually outweighed by the negative, really, really negative views. And the other theme I highlight is that what we also inherited from the British was an emphasis on pedigree, lineage. And you find by the antebellum period, by 1860, there is an emphasis, the same way people were talking about race, but an emphasis of class as something that was inherited. And that if you were a poor white, or if you were white trash, essentially your class status was seen as something that was in the blood, something that was congenital, something that was passed down through generations. And this is something that we find surprising, but it makes perfect sense if we think about how popular the eugenics movement was in the United States. The eugenics movement was a widespread movement embraced by academics, embraced by politicians. There were numerous states that passed sterilization laws in this country, and we forget that what is eugenics based on? But it was based on this idea that certain people should not be allowed to reproduce. their bloodline should be cut. And, of course, who were the people who were targeted for sterilization? The largest group would be poor white women. And, in fact, in the very famous Supreme Court case of Buck v. Bell, the woman who was focused on as the litigant in that case was a poor white woman who was selected. She was selected for sterilization in Virginia because she was seen as one of the, quote, shiftless, ignorant, and worthless class of antisocial whites of the South.
We're talking with Nancy Eisenberg right now. She's the author of the book White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think gets missed in conversations about class divisions in the United States? How do you think class is playing out in the presidential election so far? And what do you think needs to change to help bridge some of the class divides in our nation? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can also post your thoughts on our Facebook page.
Right now, we're continuing our conversation about the history of class division in the United States with Nancy Eisenberg. She's the T. Harry Williams Professor of American History at Louisiana State University and the author of the book White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. We want to know what you think about the role of class divisions in the current presidential election. What do you think about the term white trash? If you consider yourself to be blue collar or part of the working class, do you think we're honest about class divisions in America? Call now at 800-642-1234. You can also post what you think on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Nancy, in your book, you cover a big sweep of history. You've got the Civil Rights era. You've got the Civil War and onward from there. But I want to touch now on culture and how poor people have been portrayed in popular culture. And here's a clip from the Beverly Hillbillies.
What is your name?
Jed Clampett, ma'am. And this here's...
And you expect me to believe that you have $25 million?
Well, no, not on me, ma'am. But my neighbor, Mr. Drysdale... He's keeping it in his bank for me.
So in a way, is that a celebration of poor people? Is that a celebration the same way maybe the Dukes of Hazzard was? How do you read that?
Well, it's funny. The actual show's producer believed that the Beverly Hillbillies was going to change perceptions of Appalachian poor whites, rural whites. But it's not true at all, because in fact, as other newspaper commentators pointed out, part of the anxiety that's played out in the Beverly Hillbillies, this was a Chicago writer, Paul Harvey, he said that in 1968, he said, suppose a real-life likeness of TV's Beverly Hillbillies should move to the big city without those millions of dollars in the bank. And the reason he said that is this is a part of history we completely ignore. We know about poor blacks and who move and migrate in the north. But there also was a mass migration of poor whites who created what were known as hillbilly ghettos in cities such as Baltimore, St. Louis, Detroit, Chicago, and Cincinnati. And the other thing that was highlighted in the Beverly Hillbillies, it sort of shows how they can't deal with modern technology. And that even goes back to the allusions to the 1930s. Even the truck that Beverly Hillbillies drove in looked like the Jodes truck. So it has sort of overtones to the, you know, they were referred to in the 30s as squatters on wheels. So, no, I don't think you can actually see the Beverly Hillbillies as a celebration of class diversity. And another writer at the time who wrote for the Los Angeles Times felt that this is really an effort of Americans to celebrate their class consciousness, and also to use humor to camouflage class conflict, because he highlighted that every show was about, you know, was a battle between the slobs and the snobs. In that clip you ran, it talked about the banker, Milburn Drysdale, and he's always made to look foolish. The Clampetts are made to look foolish, And it was a part to sort of, as this writer said, to make the people in the middle, average viewers, feel superior to both people at the top, people at the bottom. So I think that we know, and this is one of the things I highlight, we talk about how poor whites have been such an important part, not only in our economy, not only in part of the way the class structure operates, but also part of our, political imagination, because it taps into that anxiety that what it proves is that, yeah, you can have a lot of bucks in the case of the Clampets, but they don't, in terms of their social breeding, their behavior, they don't move one step up the social ladder.
Let's get to our callers now. We've got Bob on the line first in Milwaukee. Hi, Bob.
Hey, thanks for taking the call. I have to comment. I turned you guys on and started listening. I'm just chuckling, shaking my head, because I grew up, and when I say poor, dirt poor, in a super wealthy area, and had to kind of nurse myself along and pretend that I fit in. And growing up, going to country clubs, dragged along to country clubs and exclusive resorts and those type of operations, but going home and really knowing that I had, I came from nowhere with nothing, but I lived with a group of people that were bathed in wealth, and I'm not exaggerating. So I always kind of live the mantra, too smart for NASCAR, too dumb for opera. That was kind of how I grew up, and no regrets, but it's true, people would ask, where I came from and what was my background, and I kind of had to improvise and limp along in that environment.
And Bob, just really briefly, and we've got other callers, but did you feel like you were able to, rise above your circumstances, or do you think there is something that tethers you to wherever you were born, whatever class?
My mother's parents were tea-drinking Methodist, really strict, and my father's background was partying, hard-drinking lifestyle. And I just think it was an interesting way to grow up, and I have no regrets. Obviously, I couldn't control that, but I'm glad I grew up where I did, because I see both sides of it, and I kind of fell in the middle. Got an education and bettered myself.
Bob, thank you so much. I really appreciate you calling and sharing some of your story with us. And Nancy, just briefly, so we can get to some other callers, what do you hear when you hear Bob's story?
Yeah, I think he's making a really good point. It's a point that I try to stress in this book, that class has never been simply about wealth and occupation. It's about pedigree and breeding. We still measure class today by how a person dresses, how they talk, their education level, their expressions of taste. And that's what the person who called in was highlighting. And I think one of the interesting things about being in the middle class is the idea that you're supposed to assimilate into the middle class, somehow remove those traces if you come from a working class or a rural background. And I highlight this when I'm talking about, Lyndon Johnson, that there's always that fear when I talk about the way in which people talked about the country boy. There's always a fear that somehow you'll say something inappropriate. You won't be able to conceal your artless drawl or dust the sticky red clay, that the indelible marks of class are forever there. And I think that even someone who does move into the middle class, they're very aware, as the caller was, that they don't feel like they quite belong. And it's very similar in a lot of ways to the way in which people who are black and who pass for white, that idea that you have to disguise who you really are in order to fit in.
Well, thanks again for that call, and we're going to go next to Jerry in Milwaukee. Hi, Jerry. Jerry, you with us? Nope, let's go to line three. We've got Marcus in Green Bay. Marcus, hi.
Hi. I just wondered if you guys ever heard of a phrase called white trash TV, and it has to do nothing with race or anything. It's just the shows, the programs that are available, but it's mostly, what I mean by that is the ads that are targeted towards viewers, such as myself. I'm a low-income person. I have antenna TV, and then throughout the day, and especially late at night, I'm talking mostly about the ads and how they target people of low income and who may not be educated and stuff. I'm a muter, so I don't listen to the ads. But have you heard?
Marcus, I think we are getting your gist there. And so, Nancy, you do get into television programs and what Marcus called their white trash TV, he says.
Yeah, I mean, reality TV is not reality. It's scripted. There's different shows. Different shows appeal to different things. There's the voyeurism of Honey Boo Boo, but there's also in the Duck Dynasty, which has more similarities with the Beverly Hillbillies and is this also this vaudeville tradition that even predated the Beverly Hillbillies. That's where Hee Haw came from, where you had this idea that, you know, it's sort of the slapstick hillbilly. So you have both of these traditions that are important. And I think what the caller was highlighting is the advertising. And this is something that we know. Advertising in the 20th century studied people's buying behavior. And I read this wonderful article that was published in the, like, I think 1915. And it had broken down all the classes and all the differences in terms of what their tastes were, like wine versus whiskey versus beer and everything. So, yes, clearly shows, because that's why TV was even invented or why radio was invented, was for advertising. They're very conscious of marketing class tastes.
And we leave it there. Nancy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Nancy Eisenberg. She's the T. Harry Williams Professor of American History at Louisiana State University and the author of the new book called White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America. And you can find more information about her new book on the Central Time Facebook page. You could also share your story while you're there. Just search Central Time on WPR to find us.